You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Hey, it's Mae Whitman, and I play Frankie in the new Realm podcast, The Sisters. The Sisters is about a museum curator of medical oddities who investigates the origins of a mutated skeleton with two layers of bones. Soon, she uncovers an extraordinary mystery that connects her present with one family's tragic past in hauntingly dangerous ways. Listen to The Sisters wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Muses and Stuff. This is the podcast that's all about the dolls. They were the groupies, the wives, the girlfriends, and the muses who played such a huge role in rock and roll history by simply being themselves.
They were sweet, sexy, brave, and powerful. They went after what and who they wanted, and they made no apologies.
We are your hosts, Shanti and Lynx.
Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Muses and Stuff. I'm sitting here with Lynx, kind of, but she's not actually sitting here beside me, unfortunately. So I'm Lynx and I, we've been recording these intros to these episodes, and it was going to be no different for our interview, our conversation with Denise Donlin, the conversation that you are about to hear. So usually we record our intros after we do the episode, so it's still fresh in our minds, and you know, Lynx can and I can sometimes only get together once a week, unfortunately. So we do the intros then, but we had to put it off. We had to put off doing the intro. Isn't that right, Lynx?
Yes, but for very good reason.
So if it sounds like Lynx's voice is coming out of a Bose speaker, no, it's a Head Rush speaker. It's because she is. We were going to Skype, and that wasn't working. So I was like, you know what? I'm a professional problem solver. Let me solve this problem. And so we came up with a creative solution. So the sound quality isn't going to be the greatest in this intro, but...
But it's just for the intro. Don't worry. The sound quality is great for the rest of the episode.
And, you know, I think it's just like Denise would be proud of us for coming up with this creative solution.
Sure.
Because that's what she does. Like, she's the kind of woman, she gets shit done. If there's a problem, then she just solves it. You know,
she
$171,000 problem. What was
million dollar
problem, then she can solve it. So so we've got that interview coming up for you soon, and I'm going to give you a real proper Denise Donlin description in just a moment. But Lynx, I want you to tell the people, how is Nick Cave?
Oh my god, it was incredible. I got to see him twice, and I took my dad to one, and he just loved it. If you've seen Nick Cave, everyone knows, like, there's no other performer like him. He's just incredible. And the best way that I can think to describe it is that he's like the preacher, and like we're all just his disciples, like following him. And it's unbelievable. And I happened to be up in the balcony in the first row, had the perfect view on the stage and watching it the whole time. And At one point, Nick Cave actually came off stage and walked on the chairs, like through the crowd. And he stopped and he sang down to this woman, and she was holding him. And I posted the photo on our Instagram. And I was hoping by hashtagging it that woman would find it, and she did. And I got a message from her, and I was able to send her the photos and a couple others I took. And she said that she actually is a fan of the podcast. And I thought, like, how amazing
That's
was it?
That's so cool.
People, right? Out of all the people there, like a sold-out show, like 2,600 people, someone who loves groupiedom, and she mentioned loving Pamela DeBar, and it was so fitting.
So
I'm
she
so
was
glad she got to experience that moment with Nick as well, because we all know like how amazing that feels. So
yeah, so she was already a listener. That's really, really cool.
Mm-hmm. And you had an amazing weekend too.
Oh yeah, I went to a field trip, and if people were following us on our Instagram stories, they could, I took them backstage with me and side stage for Broken Social Scene, so that was kind of fun to just make little stories about that, because it was a great festival, and the bands were amazing. People were amazing, and I got a sunburn.
The first one of the season.
That's right. So we actually didn't explain yet why we had to skip out of the intro and just hit sort of save on the podcast and put the computer down and just run out of the house.
Mm-hmm. Well, if interviewing Denise wasn't incredible enough, after we completed the interview, Denise was like, "Hey, you up for a party?" We were like, hell yeah, we are.
Yeah, so she invited us along with her to a very magical place, a very jazzy and peaceful place that I think might be heaven. Really? Is that where we went last night, Lynx? Did we go to heaven?
I just felt like it. I wrote my friend on the way home, like, I'm floating home right now. Just, it felt like we were up in the clouds for sure.
We were dancing in the street afterwards, and when you walked away, somebody in a car across the street went, "Hey, nice dancing!" I went, "Thank you." So we met so many amazing and inspiring women that I just... So, you know, you ask Denise at the end of the interview, like, what women can do for each other, and so first of all, she tells us, and then second of all, she's just like... shows us. She's like, "You know what? You want to know the answer to that question? Let me show you. Let's go, girls." And we're like, "Okay." So she's she's everything. She wears so many different hats. She's like, you know, I know that we were both nervous for this interview, but then she makes you feel so at ease because she's a friend and a sister and cool aunt. And
like my whole attitude like changed. Like all the nerves just like flew out of me. It just the minute she said, like, "Hey, how's it going?" You know,
and I
she
felt really I felt so present with her because we forgot to take a pic. Like, I was looking at her and you guys talking, and I wanted to take a photo, but I didn't want to distract you and lose your train of thought. But we're so like present in the moment that I ended up forgetting about the photo, and we didn't get one until later that night. But it was a really, really special moment. And anyways, I'm really excited about this interview, and I hope that people really like it.
Yeah, me too.
And I hope that we get to go back to heaven one day.
Yeah, for real. That was just amazing. And Denise, thank you so much for coming on and being so kind and welcoming to us. And yeah, this whole experience has been magical. And I'm excited for everyone to hear the interview because we got deep, and it's a great one.
Mm. Yes. Okay, so I'm going to read Denise's book sleeve, and it explains in such great, I don't know, I'm sorry, I'm tired. I'm like, what are words right now? Just like a lot of her accomplishments, besides being just an incredibly kind and passionate and caring, amazing, strong, empowering woman. Exactly. And beautiful. Oh, my God. She's beautiful.
I know. She's gorgeous.
Okay. I'm going to put the speaker down, and I'm going to use my other hand to grab the book. Okay, Lynx, I'm putting you down. Denise Donlin is one of Canada's most successful broadcasters and corporate leaders. She has been a co-host and producer of The New Music, director of programming and VP and general manager of Much Music and City TV, president of Sony Music Canada, general manager and executive director of CBC English Radio, and co-producer and co-host of The Zoomer. She has also devoted herself to numerous charitable initiatives, working with organizations such as War Child Canada, Music Counts, and the Clinton Giustra Enterprise Partnership. She sits on a number of boards and has been honored with the Humanitarian Spirit Award and the Trailblazer Award at Canadian Music Week, Woman of the Year from Canadian Women in Communications, Woman of Vision from Wired Women, and was inducted in the Broadcast Hall of Fame. She is a fellow of the Royal Conservatory of Music and a member of the Order of Canada. Our friend Eric Alper says, I've long recognized Denise Donlin as a trailblazer in the Canadian cultural industries as a corporate leader, a broadcaster, a feminist, and a social activist. One of Canada's most celebrated and dynamic citizens, her just-released memoir, Fearless as Possible, Under the Circumstances, is one of the greatest books I've ever read. And we agree. Enjoy the episode. This episode is brought to you by Electrified Porcupine. Electrified Porcupine is a pretty kick-ass website where you can go and read and learn all about music, gaming, wrestling, retro, TV, movies, cartoons, and collectible toys. So go to electrifiedporcupine.com and have a look around. See what you like. We are sitting here today. We have the privilege and we're so excited to be sitting here today. So
excited. I'm excited.
With Denise Donlin, or as I've been calling her, Denise freaking Donlin.
I'll take that.
Thank you so much. This is, again, such an honor.
Oh, so my pleasure. I love your energy of both of you.
Thank you. thank you so much for coming, and thank you for coming in this kind of treacherous Toronto weather.
Nasty kind of day. But that's okay. It's warm and cozy here.
Yes, it certainly is. So speaking of days, we'll just start with our first question for you, a little bit of a warm-up. Describe your perfect day.
Oh, my perfect day is waking up rested and having some Italian coffee, you know, one of those very old Italian coffee makers. And then hopefully having time to read the newspaper, which is a massive luxury. And then jumping in the car and heading to the cottage with tunes blasting all the way. And then when we get to the cottage, have a big swim and wash the city off my body. And then maybe a kayak and then a barbecue and hopefully a glass of wine with some friends. And then some more music and probably a good book and then go to sleep.
Sounds blissful.
Amazing day, yeah. Good answer.
I want to do that on Friday.
Oh, good. I'm from Northern Ontario, so I'm very much
an outdoorsy
country, swimming in lakes, swimming in rivers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was my motto when I finished the book. It was like, okay, you must spend more time outdoors. And then I was surprised to read that Hillary Clinton said the same thing. What are you going to do now? Spend more time outdoors. Oh, out of a pantsuit in a windowless, airless conference room is great.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, everybody should spend more time outdoors. So another question for you. We're going to ask you to think back a little bit. When you were 13 years old, and speaking of music or, you know, I guess it could be anything, what posters did you have up on your bedroom wall?
I had none.
Oh.
I know. We lived in a little bungalow in the east end of Toronto, and my bedroom had this kind of wooden panel in it, and it was against the law to put any holes in that wood panel. It was kind of really knotty wood, too, so sometimes at night the shadows would hit it weird, and I'd see strange faces, scary faces in the walls. Aww. As well. But when I got to university, I made up for lost time and plastered my room with posters, mostly environmental activism posters. But I remember one record that was really popular at the time, in my group anyway, because I lived with a bunch of, you know, tree huggers. I was the closet carnivore in my house of vegetarians. And it was the Muse concerts.
Yeah.
Concerts for a Non-Nuclear Future. So it was this triple album with Jackson Browne and Crosby, Stills and Nash and, you know, the Doobie Brothers and Poco and Bonnie Raitt and John Prine and Bruce Springsteen. It's just one of the best live albums you will ever hear, partly because, you know, the mission spoke to me, but also those beautiful voices all coming together. It was, you know, one of the first concerts that actually clued into me the whole idea about music plus meaning equals magic. That's where it started.
I'm actually seeing Bonnie Raitt on Friday.
Oh, she's fantastic.
Isn't she?
She's really great.
So lovely.
Yeah.
So you were a pioneer in your field, and because of that, you didn't grow up like we did, looking up to women like you. Who were your feminist icons, or who are your feminist icons?
Well, when I was young, it would have been my mom. You know, my mom, I mean, her background is practically Dickensian, right? She grew up as an orphan in England and, you know, deprived of food and certainly love. And so when she graduated, the evil stepfather, who she didn't think she had anymore, came and made, instead of a scholarship, made her go work for the family as a laundress. So for me, she would always say, "The world is your oyster, my dear," and encourage me to sort of grab a hold of opportunities because she never had them. So in the early days, she would have been my feminist mentor. Later on, it was a lot of artists, Joni Mitchell and, you know, Chrissy Hynde and Jeanette Napolitano from Concrete Blonde. I always thought she was such a badass. And then later I got more and more engaged in political feminists. So when I go to Ottawa every year, and there's one in Calgary too, there's a statue of these five women called the Famous Five, Emily Murphy, etc. And they were the ones who campaigned in 1928 or 29. It was the year my mom was born. So one generation, those were the five women who made, five ladies who made women, quote, persons under the law in Canada.
That's right. Yep.
Yeah. So they're one of my feminist icons now. Whenever I go to Ottawa, I go and I walk to the hill like a pilgrimage and I thank the Famous Five.
Pay your respects.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because we still got a long way to go.
Oh, God, yes. Yes, we do. So your book is so much more than just a memoir. It's the story.
It's everything.
Yeah.
It's kind of goofy.
It's the story of Much Music. It's a feminist manifesto. It's a guide to successful event planning and fundraising. It's a very detailed look at the business side of the music industry. And it's filled with fun memories with amazing, talented people.
It's so funny.
I'm glad you found it funny.
It's everything. It's everything. Was that always the original intention, or did this just happen naturally?
No, the original intention was sort of ego-driven, because a publisher approached me and said, "You should write a book." And of course, I was like, "Of course I should write a book." You should beware of things that are led purely by your ego. And so I thought, well, it should just be about celebrity stories, lots of bold-faced names, and maybe, you know, my son might want to find out one day what really happened on the Whitesnake 1984 slided-in tour of Europe. So I started writing celebrity stories, but it became hollow. It was like, who cares about my celebrity stories, really? So that I started to think about more thematically, more, you know, okay, the stories had to be funny, or they had to teach me something, or hopefully they had to teach the reader something. And then these themes started to develop of feminism, of being a lady leader in male-dominated industries, of humanitarianism and philanthropy. And so it became a little bit more than what I intended at the beginning. It had to be about something.
Mm-hmm. So good.
I don't think that I can compare myself to you in any way, but I mean, that's not the right way to word it.
No, you're so much more entrepreneurial than I was as a young girl.
Kind of how the podcast started. Mm. It started with stories about, okay, who are these stories of these rock stars, like in the Canadian music scene, that we went and did this with and that I had a fun time with and we got to go out and tour with? And then it became so much more than that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so even though we're saying like our podcast is about legendary music muses and super groupies, it's like, it's so not just about
it's
that
so much more,
anymore.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Even if it ever
though.
Really was.
Yeah. Because as long as you're curious and it broadens your interest, mm-hmm. then it's going to have legacy, right? Have real legs for you and the audience.
Exactly. And so many of these women, like, are layered. They all have amazing stories, and they have amazing stories within their amazing story. Mm. So you cover so much territory, and you, like, you learn so many new things, and that makes you discover other people, and it's just like a web of
exactly
growing.
Keep
growing.
At it, and then figure out how to get paid for it. Yeah.
So, oh, I like yeah. Gotcha.
If you do what you love, hopefully you can.
We first saw you speak at Canadian Music Week not too long ago, mm-hmm. and that was wonderful. And we also loved in your book, The Art of the Interview. Mm-hmm. That really helped us because the timing was perfect because we'd really just started interviewing people because for the most part, had just been you and I.
Just discussion more, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so now that we're interviewing, I just want to say thank you for those tips. They're really helpful.
Hope they were useful.
Mm-hmm. Very much.
And at the end of your panel, there was a question period. Mm-hmm. And so we almost asked a question, but instead we were just furiously writing notes. but we thought about asking the question about the representation of women on panels at music festivals. Mm-hmm. And even in terms of Canadian Music Week's panel, What Women Want, that was led by a group of men.
Yeah. No women on that panel, right?
Right.
I know. Odd.
Odd.
And not very thoughtful.
Mm-hmm. Right. But we didn't ask that question. And so my question for you now, is there a fine line between a foolish question and a fearless one?
I think there aren't really any foolish questions. The only foolish question is if it reveals that you haven't done your homework, right? Mm. If you ask a foolish question that is... the person you're asking it of just thinks, well, did you read the book? Did you listen to the record? Did you look up my biography? That's a foolish question. Any other question, which you are finding, you know, curious and that you're wondering about, then there's a pretty good chance that other people are going to be wondering about that question too. So I would just go be fearless. But I hear what you're saying. It's hard. Even, you know, I public speak, I've been behind the mic and for years and years and years. But if it's a conference and there's 400 people sitting in the audience and I think, oh, should I ask that question? I really want to ask that question. Maybe people will think I'm stupid if I ask that question. And then, you know, even when I'm standing at the microphone, my heart's pounding, right? So it's okay to be nervous, I think. Also because it makes you more prepared, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
If you're not nervous, you're probably just arrogant.
Yeah. that's good because I was feeling the nerves earlier.
Mm. Yeah, I've been rolling around this crystal in my hand for the past probably hour. I think I can maybe put it down now.
But you know what? The Art of the Interview in the book, there was, I think, 10 or 11 tips. And the reason I did it was because I was trying to find a way to organize what I thought were some pretty fun stories. Mm-hmm. And also because I was learning how to do it as I went along. Nobody trained any of us mm-hmm. in those days. They were just like, here's your camera and a microphone, off you go. And so yeah, you do learn it. And what I found was the biggest flaw was not foolish questions necessarily, but a disrespect of the artist by not doing her homework, and an arrogance on the part of the reporter who thought that perhaps they were better or more famous or more worthy of the airtime mm-hmm. than their subject. And I always thought we were just vehicles for the subject at the end of the day. And we gained a real reputation for being smart interviewers and for actually taking, you know, the interview into a world of substance versus just style, right?
Exactly.
Because it's all about the red. What are you wearing now? Nobody asks a decent question anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, that goes perfect into my next question. We grew up watching MuchMusic, and obviously the great variety of music is something we treasure so much. But what really stands out in my memory is the unbelievable quality of programming you guys had. I remember staying up late and watching the Too Much for Much.
Yeah.
You know, learning about that world and seeing like the VJs and your guests and audience members like all discussing content on TV. Mm-hmm. And I remember going downtown for Intermittent Interactives and, you know, getting to look through the window and you see a star. And
I'm sorry, I would have given you a wristband had I known you were there.
We came for a grade 8 grad trip. And it was a huge deal, you know, 6 hours on a bus, and we got a tour of Much Music, and it was so much fun. Everybody looked like that they were having a great time. We felt welcome as kids being there.
That's great.
The VJs would jump out, put their arms around us. We got pictures with Rick Campanelli and George Stoffelopoulos, and all the girls were going crazy for George, and I couldn't believe it. Watching it, being from a small town, and watching it and feeling like, oh, it's so unbelievable what they're doing, and then actually being there, and it was a really special moment.
Well, that was the great thing about Much at the beginning, because it really was the Camelot, right? Mm-hmm. It was the first time we had a national conversation, and so artists who could be famous in, you know, Red Deer, Moose Jaw, Vancouver, you know, had to get in the bus and travel and hone their craft across this great country with a small population. So as soon as Much launched, it was like, you know, people could see Prince and Boy George, and you know, they could see people wearing crazy clothes and singing about subjects that they may not have thought about before. And so it was such a powerful time for music videos. So I mean, you mentioned Too Much for Much. And for me, that whole drive for relevance piece on Much Music was, well, it's what made me get up in the morning. You know, we could play music videos all day, but I was so interested in inviting the audience in and having a dialogue, because they saw the station as their station. And so it's like, okay, let's deconstruct these videos. You know, is that dancer wearing that because she's emancipated or because she's exploited? Is, you know, what are they actually saying with these violent images? Is it something about society that we need to learn, or are they just doing it for the attention? So the whole idea of deconstructing those images and those lyrics, I think, was really important for, you know, for young people forming their own opinions about who we are going to be as people in part of a democracy. So that was the part. I hope you didn't see the Too Much for Much with the Nine Inch Nails where I stopped it.
I totally did.
Oh my. I would have been so burned at the stake for doing that now when I got cold feet.
That one's hard to forget once you've seen it.
Exactly. Oof.
One important thing also for any listeners who are in the States and don't know, a huge difference that says it all really is MTV is there in Times Square, but it's a couple levels up.
It's on the second floor.
Yeah, and here's Much Music, and it's you walk by it every day. It's right there, and you've got the windows open, so people can just, you know, look in and be a part of it.
But the podcast too was an exploration of fandom and the people who were going to the concerts and acknowledging them and their voices and their feelings, because rock and roll does not work with just the artists either.
Right. It's not one to many. It has to be a give and take, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So kind of shedding light on the people who are going to the concerts too, I just made the connection that I've never really made before, but it's letting them in now and having them be a part of the music history too, because you read the books and it's always about, and of course, like, the artists are so important. They are the conduits of the message, but it's really the people too that help to bring that to light and to weigh in on things. And it's really a back and forth. It's not
it's
just
communication.
A one-sided.
Music's about communication. Yeah. That's all it really is at the end of the day, even if it's, you know, affecting you in your head or in your heart or in your groin or in your feet. There is a call and response going on, and that's what makes it resonate. The good one, anyway.
One more thing I want to mention, talking about Much Music, was your War Child specials. I truly remember watching them and learning, and it was amazing just seeing other parts of the world that I had no idea, like, these things were going on. You guys really opened up a lot of eyes of like the youth.
Well, they opened me up too. I mean, the first time I went to the first War Child trip was really Dr. Samantha Nutt and Eric Hoskins coming into the in to meet me. And the next thing you knew, I was on a plane to Sierra Leone visiting the amputee camps and the child soldier camps. And you know, it was a crazy time because it was May of 2000 and Canada had just been named by the UN as the number one place in the world to live. And Sierra Leone had been named as the bottom, the lowest, the you know, the worst place in the world to live. And I didn't know much about it myself. And the whole idea of blood diamonds and how these gangsta warlords would be, you know, subjugating and oppressing their own people in the name of this kind of egregious wealth. And I was nervous. I mean, you know, we were child soldiers. They were 8, 9, and 10 years old, and they'd been filled up with drugs, and they'd been you know, oppressed. And just down the street is the amputee camp where women and children and men had their hands and their legs and their noses and their ears cut off. It was a scary place to be, but I found my courage in the bravery of those women and children, particularly, who were had they didn't have a voice, right? All they wanted to go to, they just wanted to go to school half the time. And so you come back from a trip like that, and there's another piece of that story in the book that I write about, you know, how we almost lost our crew, and I thought they were dead for a day. Mm-hmm. But you don't come back from one of those trips without, you know, it is a life-changing experience. You go out of your comfort zone, you do what you can to help, and you really get a sense of what you're made of and what you can handle as a person, and also what you're capable of.
When you started at Much Music, did you expect to go at this route, or was this something that sort of just happened along the way?
It happened because I was at the New Music for a number of years before I was offered the director of music programming at Much, and that, you know, this idea of, I mean, it was a time of great artist activism, right? You know, as Sting was in the rainforest and REM's doing Greenpeace and Bob Geldof was doing Live 8 the first time. And, you know, Bono was yelling at Canadian prime ministers. Well, he's still doing that a little. But the, you know, Amnesty International and the Conspiracy of Hope and Band-Aid. I mean, the world was really, artists had a lot to say and they were saying it loud and proud. And it was really resonating with the fans and with the audiences. So for me, the ability to dive into a subject like apartheid in South Africa, because it was Mandela's birthday, or because little Stephen had just written a song about not playing Sun City, was magic for me. That was like, oh, I could be a journalist and dig into these issues because the music let me. It opened the door into those things. And so I love doing that kind of relevant stuff. I mean, we still had fun and goofed around, but you know, those hour specials with Laurie and with Janelle White, that's what made us thrilled to be involved in it. And also from a business point of view, it made the show distinct in the world because we were really the only ones who were doing it with that kind of depth. And so we got access where other people didn't, right? They were like, yeah, we're going to let you talk to Peter Gabriel because he's got something to say and we know that you will receive it.
Amazing. So I'm getting all excited and fired up. And, you know, I feel like lately I've been more and more so and on the podcast coming out of the closet in the sense of explaining that I am an educator and that I work with children. Mm-hmm. So I allude to it, but I don't outright say that because of wanting to keep things separate sometimes. But in this kind of journey of speaking our truth and like using our voices, like it's like I can't even keep the two separated anymore.
Well, because you shouldn't.
Yeah. And I don't want to anymore. And I don't want to be afraid of what might happen if people find out I'm a teacher, but I have a podcast where like maybe 20% of the time we talk about sex, which isn't a bad thing. So I'm moving away from that a little bit, and that feels really good. But in our classroom this year, in our grade 6 classroom full of 11 and 12 year olds, we have been music plus meaning equals magic all year. That's how we bonded. We started right off the beginning of the year. There was the new announcement before Canada. Our school is situated upon traditional territories. Mm-hmm. We acknowledge
the
territories. Yeah,
great.
So the question was just, why is this now happening? Mm-hmm. And so really getting into that and really listening to bands like Tribe Called Red and Tanya Tikkak and the Jerry Cans, who live up in Nunavut and have their own mm-hmm. record label, and Les Hay Babies, who are a French band out in Moncton, and following Gord Downey and all these kinds of things. So they're getting really passionate. The students were getting really, really passionate over these things, which was fantastic. But it's almost hard for them, like, to find that empathy or connection with people that in other countries, like around the world, because they have their food and their water, mm-hmm. and they don't see mm-hmm. it. And we can talk about it and we can tell them. But we kind of had a breakthrough moment the other day when we were reading a book about Malala, and we've talked about Malala a lot. Mm-hmm. And actually at lunchtime, we live streamed when she was in Ottawa.
Right.
And so all of the students...
Honorary Canadian citizen.
That's right.
Love that.
The students, we ate mm-hmm. lunch in the classroom that day, and they realized that they were watching something that was very, very important. And they were like, I'm never going to forget this. And I was like, good.
How wonderful. Well done.
It was fantastic. Yeah. Girls, boys, everybody were there. I shouldn't say that anymore. We have a student who identifies as gender neutral, and mm. they came out this year, and it was fantastic. The kids were so supportive, and they were like, just let us know what we could do to support you. It's great.
What a wonderful environment.
It's been a great year.
Wonderful. I'm so pleased to hear that.
So we had a breakthrough moment where we're sitting in the circle, and because we do tons of circles, that's pretty much how they learn. It's not really desk unless they choose to go there when they want to work on their work and kind of be alone. We read the book about Malala and how she just wanted education, and she wanted education for girls. And in 2009, when they were trying to take that away, she stood up against that and started writing about it. And so one of my students said, Madame, that's where I was born. I was born in the same place that Malala was. And I said, why did your parents come here? And she said, well, because they wanted me to have education and to have everything that we have. And then we all just kind of took a big breath and went,
mm-hmm.
that could have been, you know, one of our girls. Mm-hmm. Like, so it gives them that connection. But you know, where Much Music was, we were able to have that connection and to see what was going on in the age of Netflix and YouTube. Are our youth getting this same thing?
Well, I think you're, as a teacher, you know, you're correct in steering them towards it, because, you know, the internet is a wonderful thing. I mean, particularly for countries that are developing and need access to the outside world, you know, to help in all kinds of ways for sustainable development and civilization and education. So there's a wealth of great things. There's also a wealth of crap out there. And, you know, many of the things, you know, the clickbait, the computer games, etc., they're designed with capitalism in mind, right? So I always say to my son, it's like, you know, they put heroin in those games, right? Because they want you to keep playing. And it can be such a waste of time. So if you are... Because I don't find often that people find their tribe or their community or the things that are passionate for them unless there's some spark that's lit somehow, which you've talked about with Malala, or even talking about music and meaning in the classroom. And then they can explore, you know, what it means to be part of that community. They can also, you know, I was a little despondent after the Women's March. I was very... You know, it was inauguration day, and I was just like, oh my God, we've got this ass in the White House, and, you know, I know what his views are on sexual freedoms and reproductive rights and all of that. We're going to be cast back into the dark ages.
The kids are not happy about it. They're paying attention.
I am glad. And so is my son. It's fantastic. Because they're in a liberal system, though, that allows them to. They could also be in families similarly in America where everything he says is right and thou shalt not question, and yes, we're members of the NRA, right? So, but during that march, what I was, as I said, I was feeling despondent, But I saw so many women and men and kids marching, you know, to show their voice and to share their voice in a very analog way. We are marching down the streets and we've made signs and we've colored them. But I left that event thinking, you know, there's a lot that's wrong with the world, but never before have we as citizens had so many tools at our fingertips to agitate and to communicate and to build community and to stand up and protest when we think things are wrong and support things when we think they're right. So there's always a bit of a yin-yang going on. I wish there were more protest songs. I haven't heard the great protest song that's making me rise out of my chair. I mean,
I'm with you on that, yeah.
You're right about Tanya Tagaak, and because in many ways the First Nations movement is our civil rights movement of our time, I think. And Gord Downie, you know, bless his heart really is as big as his talent.
Mm-hmm.
To use his time on this planet that he has still with us, to use his powers for good, to stand up and, you know, point at the prime minister and give him an edict, and to open a window, you know, a pop culture window into a period of our past that is so shameful and requires retribution and respect. I mean, we're talking about a culture whose music and culture they were robbed. It's egregious, and we have to make amends. So I think there may not be the big protest song, but there are lots of small acts of faith that are happening out there. You know, even World Pride Day used Lorraine Segato's Rise Up as a World Pride Day song. That song's 20, I don't know how many years old it is, but it's still resonating with people.
Mm-hmm.
I think we will hear those songs. There's certainly enough to talk about.
I'm sure they're being written right now.
I hope so.
I mean, Father John Misty, for an example.
Misty's a great example. Yeah,
yeah, and he has that album where, even though it was written a few years ago, it's just, he's just telling it in this mm-hmm. way, you know. And yeah, I was trying to think of that too. Like, so who are the ones that are coming up with these messages? And I mean, I was thinking about, you know, seeing Mac DeMarco not too long ago and his whole album being about like growing up and about his father. And sometimes it's like evaluating like where we came from and who we are and understanding ourselves
mm-hmm.
and then realizing that everybody is kind of doing the same thing.
Is he the one with that great song about LGBTQ rights and how, I think he was singing about how, I mean, he's not personally gay, but that it's a human right and standing up for it. I think that's him.
I don't know. If he was and I didn't know that, I'd be like, good for you, Mac. Yeah. But we should definitely look into that.
Sounds like something he would do.
Cool.
One thing I wanted to
Oh, no, that was Macklemore and Ryan Lewis. Sorry.
It's like, it doesn't sound like Mac DeMarco, but Macklemore. Sorry. Okay,
very
good.
Close enough. Know. Okay, good.
Oh, I know that song. That's
Same
a great
love,
song.
Yeah. Yeah. Some love.
Same love. Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's a good one.
Yeah, and a really moving video too.
It's like
really
a
good
rap song, and it's nice to hear like a rapper rapping mm-hmm. about equality and gay marriage.
Yeah, we can
rights.
Throw that out to listeners too. Let us know, who are you listening to that's inspiring, that's got a message, that's got some meaning.
I'd love to hear that.
We'd love to hear that.
Because, you know,
make a playlist.
When rap started, you know, it was, as Chuck D said, sort of the black CNN. It was,
it had a message.
Yeah, but, you know, inner city and poverty and slavery and Gil Scott Heron and Grandmaster Flash, it was very politicized.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, style over substance again. That's why I think that, you know, your references to Tanya Tagaak and Tribe Called Red, I mean, they're doing what hip-hop was doing 30 years ago, singing about many of the same issues with the same intensity and purpose that fuels that music.
Mm-hmm. I was talking to Tim from A Tribe Called Red at Field Trip Festival a couple days ago on the weekend. And when I walked up into the conversation, he was talking with somebody about how Thunder Bay is racist. And I said, okay, so what's going on here? So Thunder Bay, he said, yep, there's been all of that, all of the children who have gone missing, like a couple of 14 and 17-year-old children who have gone missing, found in the water, and the police aren't doing anything about it. And there's no inquiry going into that. And I went, I didn't even know that this was going on.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. And then, so one thing that we're like learning about with the students is those seven sacred teachings. And, you know, one of them is just making sure that they're not ignorant to things like that, that now that they know, they need to do these things. And as much as I do want to celebrate Canada's 150th mm-hmm. anniversary with them, Canada's much older than that. So I couldn't just go, you know, like Gord Downie saying Canada's not just hockey and donuts. We really need to look back and evaluate and think really critically about this kind of stuff. And kids, how do you want to see the next 50 years, the next mm-hmm. 100 years, the next 150 years from now? What do you want your Canada to look like? Because it's going to have to start here, and it's going to have to then go and go down that way.
Well, and it's not just, you know, Indigenous rights. It's, it's, you know, Canada. Toronto is now, I think, the most multicultural city in the world, right?
Yeah.
Canada, you know, aspirationally is a leader in terms of how, you know, people from different races and creeds and all of it can live well together. But, you know, this idea the word tolerance keeps coming out, and I hate that word. I'm really, tolerance is just not empathetic enough. It's not mm-hmm. strong enough. It's passive aggressive. It's like, okay, I'll tolerate your views, mm-hmm. but it doesn't embrace or celebrate the differences. And, you know, we will not be successful in this journey as Canada unless we work at it. It's not going to happen because we wish it. We have to be very, very sensitive about what we're doing and why we're doing it, and use, you're right, this 150 to imagine what our future is going to be, and then work hard at it, really mm-hmm. hard.
I'm willing to put in the work. Mm-hmm. I want to do it.
Yeah.
And when I look around the classroom and I see so many different faces, so many students whose parents are from Somalia. I've got lots of students from Serbia, just all kinds of religions, and we all get along so well. Mm. And we all have so much fun, and everybody just sees the beauty in each other.
Right.
And that's how, and that's this, the city that they were raised in, mm-hmm. and it's so nice, it's so inspiring, and they're all so beautiful, every single one of them.
you just give me shivers down both my legs.
Hopefully, yay, all next generation are as amazing as you.
Exactly.
Like, they're for their final project. They're all doing podcasts. So some of them have chosen Greenpeace. Some of them have chosen Amnesty International. Some of them have chosen Gord Downie. Mm-hmm. Hannah Alper.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know who that is?
I do know who that is.
So I'm saying, look, she's 15. Okay, guys, mm-hmm. we can talk the talk, but like, well, we are going to talk it still, but we really need to, let's get outside of these walls too. Let's share with other people, like, really what you've learned, and like, what are we going to call the podcast? Like, don't worry, we got this.
Like, don't worry, we got this.
The future.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. First of all, I'm really sorry for the crap we left you. Really sorry.
Yeah.
And now,
thank God you're equipped.
That's right. I'm inspired that you can fix it. Yay. Oh. Okay.
All right, we're going to take it back to the book for a minute.
Okay.
You discuss something that I experience, and I think a lot of other people, you call it the imposter syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just, I guess, someone who has that little self-conscious thought in your head, like, why am I here? Like, I don't deserve this. Or
yeah, they're going to find out you've been faking it all along.
Yeah.
I know.
Need good teachers telling them you're good enough.
That's true.
First of all, it's also great to hear successful people who you admire saying that they also experience this.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice to know you're not alone in it.
It's real.
So my question is, you were hired as president of Sony Music just as Napster came out,
mm-hmm.
and then later executive director of CBC when they were facing a $171 million
shortfall. Woohoo!
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how did you deal with like the level of stress that coming into those situations must have been? And with that imposter voice, like, how do you turn that off?
Well, one of my sort of ways to deal with the imposter syndrome, because, and he's a boy in my head, he's the imposter demon, I call him. I used to carry him around in my backpack. He does. He's pernicious. It's like he's there when you're standing at the podium. He's there when you're thanking the Academy, when they're giving you an award. He's mm-hmm. still there. You're going to fail. Yeah. They're going to find out. But I used to bury him with busyness. I was just like, okay, I'm just going to be so busy. I'm not even going to think about you. But it was hard at the end of after Sony, because it was a merger, and you know, he just popped up and ran into my room and sat on my chest so hard I could barely breathe. But at the end of the day, you know, you build confidence only by doing, right? And so sometimes you got to shout it out of your own head. So going into Sony, I mean, I was trying to learn the music business at the same time as literally the carpet was pulled out from under the world. You know, Napster was a disruptive little Dickens, and he was, him and his friends, who like to share music for free, it toppled the world as we knew it. I worried about it sometimes. I would sit in the car or drive to work in the morning thinking, oh God, my company's expecting leadership, and, you know, maybe a well-seasoned man could have been handling this a little better than me. And I would have to give myself a pep talk and stand up to my full height, which is 6'1", and stride in, exuding, even if I didn't always feel it, as much confidence as I could muster, because the staff, the employees, the artists, they don't want to see somebody, you know, buried in their own, you know, self-worth esteem problems. They want leadership. They want vision. They want action. They want, okay, here's what we're going to do about it. So for me, it was about team building within the organization. I mean, at Sony, we had, you know, we signed artists, we promoted them, we marketed artists, but we also, you know, had a CD plant and a DVD manufacturing plant, and we shipped and had a distribution arm. So I would, you know, every quarter stand up to President's Breakfast, we called them, and I'd walk through the numbers with all of the staff and say, here's what we're doing, here's where we're going, here's what the numbers are saying. And they didn't need me to know the numbers. They knew that, you know, the person beside them just got laid off, or they were touching a lot less product going out into the trucks that day. But together, we can reinvent this business. So we had, you know, great leadership meetings that could be, you know, the guy who packed and picked it in the back sitting with the executive and the VP of marketing. And it's like, good ideas come from anywhere. Let's just pull together and see what we can reinvent, because the business as we knew it was going the way of the dinosaur. So had to be reinvented. And it's still, you know, 16 years later from when I was there, no less. So 2000 was when I joined Sony. 2016 was the first year that actually the sale of pre-recorded music went up by 3.2%, which is a rounding error in any other business, but thrilling for the record business, because it meant it was finally starting to turn around with, you know, lots of new technologies available for people to access and enjoy music.
Amazing.
Did you use Napster? We didn't know any better. We didn't know what it was doing.
Yeah.
How old would we have been?
I like maybe 11 or 12.
Yeah. Yeah. I was maybe 10, so.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
We were just learning about the internet.
Well, it was a gold mine. I mean, suddenly you could get anything you wanted at any time you wanted it. I mean, you know, Napster was an illegal file sharing service at the beginning. So, yeah, so you were at risk of filling your computer with viruses and nasty things.
We did.
Yeah. And the business tried, and I go through it in the book. I do about 10 mea culpas. Here's what we did right. Here's what we really did wrong. I mean, when we started suing the fans, that was really a bad idea. although Canada didn't do that. Mm-hmm. We did not do it. But we didn't innovate quickly enough. We thought the music business at large thought they could lawyer themselves out of it. They thought, you know, we got a J-Lo record coming next quarter. She's going to save everything and the numbers are going to be right. But it really was not just Napster. It was symptomatic of an industry that had become very top heavy, very, you know, money. It became anti-art in a way. Developing artists, used to take years and years. Now we were expected to develop an artist in 6 months or 8 months and throw it against the wall. If it didn't hit, oh, well, we'll go on to the next thing. So it became short-sighted. And yeah, there was a lot of ills in the business, which, you know, I talk about in the book. It's like, okay, mea culpa. Mm-hmm. I was just trying to figure it out. I was like, and who are these people? What's going on?
It's crazy to think of like how many artists there are out there that could have developed into someone long lasting, but because of the way the business was at that point, just never worked out for them.
Well, it's true. So many, I mean, there's a paragraph in the book and I won't remember all the examples, but artists like, you know, Bob Dylan or
I think Bruce Springsteen.
At the beginning, Rush for sure. They never had a number one hit single, but they kept going. The label believed in them. They believed in themselves more so. And so they developed a fan base and great successes through other ways. But yeah,
became Zeppelin too, I think.
It became very hit oriented.
Yeah, you need to define your own measure of success before you get into anything like that, and we certainly had to do that with this, and that's what we said. We're like, we're not checking our numbers all the time expecting 20,000 downloads from like an elementary school teacher, and you know what I mean, like it's just somebody not in the business like that would, but that's not our definition of success. But a lot of the times, like, you know, kids too, they're like, well, how many hits on YouTube did it get, and how many followers do you have, and
how many
and it's like, you know what, it doesn't matter, because we always said if it's that it, you know, you have to keep consistent, you need to, and then the content will speak for itself, so that hopefully it will start to put in the work, and if it starts to catch on and people start realizing, oh, they're onto something, that's great. But patience is key, consistency is key, and then defining our own level of success. And it's, if 12 people listen every day and they learn something, great. And now it's much beyond that, and that's fantastic.
And as long as we're enjoying it still.
But, you know, when musicians aren't given that opportunity or don't set themselves up for that as well, like, yeah, the whole reality TV thing is...
Yeah, that was a wrong rabbit hole to go into. But, reality TV, I don't mean you.
I do want my own reality television show. No.
Someone
no,
has
no.
to die now at the end. Yeah.
Do you practice yoga?
I do.
Yeah.
I like a hot yoga. I like the moksha yoga. I don't do it as much as I should, but I try and do it every day. I'm embarrassed to say this. I have a tape, a Rodney Yee tape that I've been doing. I bought it on VHS. That's how old I am. For probably 20 years, the same tape. I buy tons more. I download lots of different ones, but I keep going back to that one.
Yeah.
Because I get up in the morning and I go straight to the basement. If I stop and have a cup of tea or check my phone, I'm done. And then usually I wake up halfway through it because it's such a body memory. I know the tape so well. Mm-hmm. And then I'm halfway through it. I'm like, oh, I'm halfway over. This is pretty awesome. And then it also frees my mind to think about other things, right? I love getting ideas on the mat.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's a couple of different kinds of yoga that is that moving meditation. One of them is Ashtanga, where you have that set series of you get in front and you start and you do the whole primary series. And it's the same thing over and over again until you're not thinking what comes next and what you just do it. And that's exactly what that is.
Yeah. Free your mind.
Free your mind.
And the rest will follow.
I've been bringing very much the yoga and mindfulness into the classroom these days. You quoted Neil Young in your book saying, "We believe that Canada deserves to have the right to clean air, clean water, a clean home, and a clean environment in their constitution." So I think by what I've seen, I think by incorporating the yoga and the mindfulness and getting out into nature and getting outside with them and not restricting learning into the classroom, they're being a lot more mindful of this, of first starting with themselves and then moving outwards. I'm seeing a small shift in education in the sense that other educators are starting to realize that this is what children need as well, instead of like keeping them inside under these lights and just like hammering math and literacy and assessment down their throats.
The rote and regurgitation. It doesn't work for actually a lot of students.
But they're trying to tell us to differentiate and be equitable to the child. Like the schools, and this is not throwing the school under the bus, but it's their three things are equity, well-being, and then one other thing that has to do with pedagogy. But it's usually the pedagogy part that they're really stressing with the assessment and the literacy and the math and how are we doing with that, and EQAO is coming up and blah, blah, blah. But really, school is much more about that. Mm-hmm. And it's more about learning. It's more about learning facts. It's learning skills for a lifetime. And so I'm more interested in inspiring and shaping kids in this sense. And I'm hoping, do you think that it's naive to think that, like, that schools are, that public education is getting on board with this, or because education is a business that we're not going to see that
happen? Well, that's, you put your finger on it. It is a business, and you know, it's also an institution. So institutions are very difficult to change.
I know.
And these measurements, right, that they have, the metrics around success, are also sort of quite archaic in my mind. I mean, I had a great public school education. I really, you know, I think we're blessed as Canadians to have such a good public school system. But, you know, it's provincial, so things aren't necessarily equitable in towns across the country, north or south or east or west. And I think that this whole idea of, you know, reading, writing, arithmetic is just so linear, right? It's like I campaign a lot for music education in the schools, because when there's budget cuts and it is a business, the arts in it is usually one of the first things to go. And I think it's arts. I mean, music education, learning music in school actually makes you a better human, but it improves your math scores too. It gives you better acuity in terms of team building and social acuity as well. So for it to be one of the first things, I mean, you know what? It's really nice that we know the square root of 144, but I can actually do that on my phone now. Mm-hmm. But what might be better for me as a human is being able to communicate with other, you know, students in my class, musically, in artistically, you know, visual arts, that sort of thing. So I think we need a better balance. And especially, as you say, with so many people coming from, young people coming from different countries in the world, I mean, expecting everybody to learn the same way by having 40 kids and a desk and a teacher up the front, I think it's short-sighted. It doesn't respect the student enough. So
I agree.
Putting more money into education would never be a bad investment.
Yeah, I think you'd be hard pressed to find anybody who would disagree. Mm-hmm. And so anyways, I feel like, and I'm sure you're the same way, when you ask the, like, with your 50% memoir and this, was that a conscious decision? Did you always know that you were going to do this? And I feel like we were all sort of born to do these certain things, and we can look back at our childhoods and be like, well, this part of me and these experiences, we've always been kind of on this path. And now that we have this information and now that we have these voices, we don't really have any other choice anymore, do we?
Yeah.
We have to just keep going. Yeah. We have to use it.
Well, it is so. I mean, as a mom, right, I look at my son, Duncan, and I fully believe that he came out fully formed, right? He knew he's going to be who he's going to be. And my job as a parent is just to expose him to as many different things as I possibly can, you know, sports and physical and music and you know, academic and visual arts and all the rest of that, summer camps, like just bring it on, because only that way will he be able to pick and choose what actually works for him and what lights that passion inside him. So, yeah, their kids are going to be who they're going to be. But hopefully they're exposed to enough things that they have a good choice around it.
Amazing. Mm. Okay. Mm. Well, I think
I got one more question.
Okay.
So it's said that men get hired on potential and women get hired on experience. You were lucky enough to get hired on potential when you sort of started out. Is there anything we can do to stress the importance of investing in female potential?
Oh, God, we must. I mean, the numbers are so egregiously bad. When you look at You know, the numbers of women CEOs, it's still like at 5% in the Forbes companies. You look at the numbers of women in boards, it's still at only about 20%. That, you know, the chairwomen on board, it's in the single digits. Women in politics is in like 20%, despite the prime minister saying, you know, gender equality in the cabinet because it's 2015. Actually, the year he did that, I was finishing the book, and Canada on the parliamentary world scale, the number of women elected to politics was at number 54. We were tied with Mauritania, which is an Islamic republic. Mm-hmm. 2 years later, this year, mm-hmm. we're at 64. We actually dropped. So other countries are getting better, maybe. But we don't have enough women in politics. We don't have enough women running things. And they say 30% is a critical mass. 2 years ago, after the prime minister did the 2015 speech, many, many companies and corporations said, okay, we'll take it on. And the needle hasn't moved. Not a bit. It hasn't moved. So if you have only men at the boardroom table, you're limited by your ideas. And this goes for diversity, too. You know, if you have old white men sitting around, nothing against old white men. But, you know, it's like eating Wonder Bread all day, every day. Like there's, you know, sourdough and pumpernickel and whole wheat and, you know, grains. Like bring it all in. And we'll be better for it. And, you know, having women in politics means that we won't have only men making choices on our sexual freedoms, our reproductive rights, mm-hmm. our daycare, education, the so-called women's issues. Like, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the economy and finance and foreign affairs yeah. as well, right? Oh, yeah. Women's voices in all of those areas are so vitally important, especially now. So, yeah, I was hired on, in many ways, and this is me, I guess, the little imposter syndrome again, you were just faking it. Maybe I was in the right place at the right time. But it's still true today that women we have to work harder, we have to jump higher, we have to do more work, we have to juggle more things. I mean, I almost called the book Backwards and in High Heels, because that was the quote, you know, Ginger Rogers. Yeah, did everything Fred Astaire did except backwards and in high heels. Yeah. But the only thing, and I watched actually a dance that they did, and I looked at it and I thought, yeah, she is doing absolutely everything he's doing. The only thing she's not doing is leading. And women need to lead more. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to mentor each other better. We have to encourage you. I mean, I think sometimes women, once they, you know, it's really hard to get to the C-suite, the corner office. It's really hard. You have to work really hard. You have to make sacrifices. The work-life balance thing, which I call an extreme sport, you know, you'll never get it right. You have to make choices. You have to forgive yourself if you make the bad ones. But when you're there, it's not rarefied air where only one can be there. We need to lend a hand, put a hand down and help and pull somebody else up and give them the opportunity. Because my experience, when I hire women, I am never disappointed.
Amazing.
And we just have to thank you so much for seeing some potential in us, because
that go get them, ladies!
You're over here having this conversation with us, and a part of us like can't believe it, but we're so grateful, and we're like, it's
that absolutely my
she's
pleasure.
She's the answer to that question that you just asked her.
Exactly.
Yeah. So we really, really encourage everybody to pick up a copy of Denise's book, Fearless as Possible, Under the Circumstances. We've both read it twice. We will read it again. It will be one of those things that we read over and over again. And you
thank
just look Denise Donlan up on, you just put that name into Google and they'll find you everywhere, right? Because a lot of times you say, well, where can they find you on the internet?
Yeah, you can find me. I'm there.
Everywhere. You just you just put in Denise Donlan. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. It was a delight. It was a lovely conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
And
so
I'm
much.
So glad you enjoyed the book.
Yay. It's the best. Yeah. It's the best.
And we read a lot of books.
You do. You're packed with books. I should have brought you some boxes of books.
Ooh. All right. Well, thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll see you next week.
Yay.
Have you ever watched a futuristic sci-fi movie and wondered, but wait, could any of this really happen? And will I live long enough to see it? That's what our show Hypothetical is about. I'm Carrie Bechet, and on this podcast, we ask what-if questions about the future. Like, what if we could read minds? What if the world's digital data was erased all at once? What would happen if the Yellowstone supervolcano erupted? Then we explore that question two ways, through speculative science fiction and through dialogue with brilliant scientists. The result is a genre-bending narrative that's interwoven with real facts provided by literal geniuses. And, spoiler alert, a lot of the science fiction out there, it's not nearly as far-fetched as you might think. Come time travel with me into the future on Hypothetical. New episodes on Tuesdays, available on all your favorite podcast apps. Just search Hypothetical. That's H-Y-P-E-R-T-H-E-T-I-C-A-L.